Blog Talk Radio.
And good morning from Fairfax, Virginia. Actually, afternoon, sorry. And it's time for another edition of Military Monday. My name is John Gresham. I am your host. And today we're going to be talking about one of my favorite subjects, which is the U.S. Navy. Any of you who've listened to past shows knows that navies have always been a passionate interest of mine. And today I have the pleasure of sharing the hour with not only someone who is arguably one of the leading experts and commentators on naval developments in the U.S. and around the world, but also a good friend, someone I've been a co-author with, and that is Norman Pulmar. Norman, are you there?
I'm here, John. Always good to chat with you, although I must admit I prefer doing it over a glass of wine and lunch.
We shall do that again soon, sir, I promise. And
okay.
Norman, I have to say that when I first started as a young man taking a genuine interest in our Navy and other navies, your name was one of the earliest ones I saw in places like the pages of Proceedings and on my local library bookshelves. And to say that you've been a prolific writer on the subject of navies and maritime power is a little bit of an understatement. What is your count of books at this point that you've written?
Well, remembering that there is one novel called Ship of Gold about sex and pirates that did very well, and several books in the intelligence area, I've had 51 published books and, I don't know, several hundred articles ranging from the Naval War College Review and Naval Institute Proceedings to the New York Times and Washington Post.
And, of course, there are those occasional television appearances that we get to see you on.
Yeah, I do a few of those.
What was it that drew you to writing about the Navy and navies in general when you were a young man?
Well, as a young kid, my closest friend, for a number of reasons, was my grandfather, Louis Wolfe. And Louis and I, every couple of weeks, would Saturdays, I'd either skip synagogue or afterwards, he and I would go downtown when I was a young kid, 12, 13, 14, and we'd go to the movies. And across the street on 9th Street in Washington, before the FBI building was erected there, there were a couple of secondhand bookshops. And one day, while looking at paperback books, hoping to find some with interesting women on the covers at age 12 or 13, I came across the Naval Institute Proceedings, a phenomenal magazine. I bought a few for 10 cents a copy because they had lots of pictures of ships and airplanes. And one thing led to another, and when I was 18, they published the first article I ever wrote and even paid me $30-some dollars for it.
A not uncommon experience among our circle of friends, as you would agree.
No, Naval Institute Proceedings has introduced many, many bright people, and some not so bright, yours truly and probably included, into naval matters.
And by this we include such names as Tom Clancy, Steve Koontz, among others, and
quite a few others. Eric Wertheim, who's editor-in-chief of Combat Fleets of the World.
Who was a former guest on this show, yes. So, Proceedings, of course, is kind of a nexus for people like us. And in addition, as part of the Naval Institute, there's something else called the Naval Institute Press, which puts out what can only be described as wonderfully focused books on maritime matters. Talk a little bit about that press and your involvement with them.
Well, the Naval Institute Press publishes about 80 paper, that is real books per year, plus increasingly electronic books. The press started, well, the Naval Institute started in the late 1800s when a group of naval officers at the Naval Academy and a few civilian professors decided they had to start writing and holding meetings to discuss the demise of the U.S. Navy, and this is the 1780s. One thing led to another, and pretty soon their proceedings of their meetings at the Naval Academy were published, and this became the Naval Institute Proceedings magazine. Subsequently, and I don't recall the year, but very early in the last century, very early in the 20th century, they started publishing some handbooks, the Blue Jackets Manual, the Naval Officer's Guide. And these, in turn, led to books and books and books and books, and authors such as Steve Koontz, Tom Clancy, and a few other people who are well-known in the field. But their books cover a range of subjects from, as I say, semi-manuals, such as the Naval Officer's Guide, the Marine Officer's Guide, the Naval Aviator's Guide, to a few very popular novels.
And we're going to talk more about the publishing end and your efforts of late with them later. For our guests, if you'd like to call in and talk to Mr. Polmar or myself, our call-in line is 347-945-7246. Please feel free to call in if you'd like. And Norman, what is it about navies that is so seductive to people like you and myself? What is it about navies that drew you in to go and want to talk about them and write about them?
Now, that's a damn good question, John, and I wish I had the answer, but I don't. One could say ships are more glamorous somehow than airplanes. Ships last longer. I mean, the life of a modern warship is measured 25, 35 years. Aircraft carriers can last 50 years. A couple of World War II-era destroyers are still being operated, by Central American navies. So possibly ships are prettier than airplanes. They're bigger, they're more impressive, and they tend to last longer.
They're architectural,
too. Tanks don't really count. I mean, tanks are tanks. But there's something just almost romantic about ships.
And what ships drew you in when you were a young man, when you started flipping through the pages of Proceedings? What ships
probably battleships, because the very first article I wrote when I was 17, as I say, it was published when I was 17 or 18, was about battleships and how great they were. Later, when John Layman was Secretary of the Navy and I was a consultant directly to him, we got into a few disagreements because by that time I realized we could not afford battleships anymore.
And so that brings us to the question of our Navy. Obviously, there's been a Navy since just after we decided to go and rebel against Great Britain in one form or another, continuously to today.
Up the rebel.
And up the rebel, down the redcoats, yes. That said, if you had to sit down and do a Reagan-esque 50-word opening of the state of the U.S. Navy today, how would you describe it?
The U.S. Navy is in considerable trouble today. The biggest problem is the problems that the Navy faces are very broad across the board, from such issues as strategy down to Navy working uniforms. The Navy has spent hundreds of millions of dollars developing and procuring working uniforms, what the Army used to call fatigues and now call camis. The Navy has been unable to get it right. They can't find a uniform that the enlisted people like. They can't find a uniform that's fireproof, and yet they've invested hundreds of millions of dollars. One only has to read the letters to the editor of Navy Times, which is a weekly privately published newspaper, to see the great dissatisfaction in the fleet with the Navy's efforts in something as mundane as a working uniform. As I say, it starts with strategy. The Navy has no strategy today, in my opinion. It's just keep building the kinds of ships we're building. The one exception has been the innovative LCS, Littoral Combat Ship, initiated a decade ago. But other than that, we just want to keep building what we're building and hope that they work in the context of strategy, that they can carry out the missions that the Navy's assigned. But at every level, from the quality of ships to the types of ships we're building, in my opinion, the Navy is in great trouble.
Let's start with that question of strategy. Once upon a time in the 1980s, back when you were consulting to Mr. Layman, who was at that time Secretary of the Navy, there was something called the Maritime Strategy that was designed by the Navy, was not necessarily part of a national strategy, but it was the working document that the Navy hoped to follow in the event of a war with the Soviet Union. Talk about that a little bit, and then move to the post-Cold War period and what we have today that passes for strategy.
Well, the maritime strategy actually began just before Lehman arrived, when Admiral Hayward was chief of naval operations. And he wanted a document that would explain how the Navy would, one, carry out the national military strategy, and, two, how the Navy would fight the Soviet Union. It was a very bipolar world then. In that context, John Lehman picked up on it, refined it, and with the help of Admiral Watkins, who was his subsequent chief of naval operations for 4 years, Lehman also was able to weave into it his plan to increase the Navy to 600 ships, and it reached 594 or 595, as I recall. But here we had a single document that at every level of the Navy, from lieutenant to four-star admiral, one could look at it as a task force commander. One could say, hey, this is what my forces are going to do. Once Lehman left, and later Senator Webb became Secretary of the Navy, of course, the new administration, the new Navy administration, a new CNO, a new Secretary of the Navy, had to come up with their own strategy, but Webb was there too short a time to develop one. Subsequently, every CNO, Chief of Naval Operations, since the mid-80s, and Lehman stepped down, I believe it was March of 87, has tried to develop. Once the Chief of Naval Operations came up with the four pillars of naval strategy. One came up with the 1,000-ship strategy because he was going to integrate the rest of the free world's navies into the U.S. operations. All of these fell flat on their face because they just did not have any real basis in logic, in geography, and in just a knowledge of how navies operate. And today, in my opinion, there is no U.S. Navy strategy.
Now, isn't there something called air-sea battle that we heard bits and pieces about, though never really had explained by the current administration?
Air-sea battle, which started under the previous administration, was an attempt to show how the U.S. Air Force and Navy, not the Army and minimal participation of the Marine Corps, could overcome any efforts by China or other countries to essentially defend their coast, to map out areas, like for China, the South China Sea, and develop forces to keep U.S. naval or allied naval forces out of those areas. So sea air battle is a concept, in my opinion, more than a plan, of how we are going to overcome, roll back, if you will, those defensive forces of China, of Iran, of North Korea. The problem is, even if one develops a concept of operations, which you call sea air battle, every geographic area is going to be different. In addition, every country, Iran, North Korea, China, perhaps someday the Soviet Union, and the countries they supply weapons to, such as Syria right now, there are going to be different weapons facing us. We're going to have different requirements as to what we want to do. For example, if we roll back China's defenses, what are we going to do then? Land Marines on the coast of China? Are we going to effect a regime change in Beijing? And they're just concepts. Sea air battle is a set of concepts which, in my opinion, one, have not been thought out, and two, do not fall into an overall strategy. But
now,
this
counters the so-called anti-access strategy of the Chinese, in theory,
right? It's not
right?
So-called. It is an anti-access strategy. But the point is, if we can overcome it, if we can get enough of the right kinds of forces to the right place in time, and we can overcome it, what do we do then? Why do we overcome it? Again, do we want to, as I just said, to change the regime, the leadership in Beijing? Do we want to land soldiers and Marines on the coast of China? Do we want to destroy their nuclear arsenal? It's a concept of things we're going to do primarily to justify more ships and aircraft, but beyond that, there's just no strategy with it.
It is as essential as you would say a road to nowhere at the moment. There is no
exactly.
end state we're talking about.
Correct.
Well, moving on from that, let's talk about another situation that has become a genuine crisis, and that is the question of shipbuilding. Shipbuilding plans are, in many cases with many nations, fallacies of what they dream of, but not what they can afford nor industrially carry out. There's long been the hope of eventually regrowing the U.S. Navy up above 300 ships to maybe even 330. I would say that is obviously not going to happen now. Can you give us your thoughts on that and where you think the number of ships is going to be in the years ahead?
Well, I have no idea what the number of ships will be in the years ahead. We have about 285 what they call battle force or real commission ships in the Navy today. We could get to 300. We could get to 330 if, for example, we keep building 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 littoral combat ships per year. And these are small, in theory, multi-purpose ships, small, about 3,000 tons the size of a World War II destroyer. However, there's no way, in my opinion, with all the problems the LCS, a littoral combat ship, has encountered, there's no way Congress is going to let the Navy build 50-some of these, which is the current plan. It just depends on what Congress does, what political pressures are brought on Congress by various shipyards in the congressional districts where they are located. By the same token, if something happens overseas, if we get into a semi-shooting war with, say, North Korea or Iran, suddenly there'll be screams, we need more ships. It's very difficult to predict. The Navy has a 30-year shipbuilding program, which Congress has declared they have to provide every year, and it's the most ridiculous, and there are a lot of ridiculous pieces of paper in Washington, John, but the 30-year shipbuilding program is the most ridiculous because it changes every year. What we need, and I hate to bring up the Soviet Union in this discussion, but the Soviets had a 5 or 6 year plan, and they damn well tried to fulfill the plan, and that's what we need for the Navy, say a 5 or 6 year plan, where the Chief of Naval Operations, the Secretary of the Navy, the Secretary of Defense say this is what we plan for the next 5 or 6 years, and it's not changed unless there's a reason to change it, such as a war or some other major event. But instead, every year, Congress looks at what their congressional districts are saying. The Navy looks at, what can we get away with? The Navy leadership, as far as the Secretary of the Navy goes, is exceedingly weak right now, the Secretariat. So there is no strategy, overall strategy, and within the lack of an overall strategy, there's a lack of a program as to where we want to go with ships. Now, there are three programs. There's an air, surface, and submarine, because each of those communities in the Navy, the aviators, the surface warriors, and the submariners, or submariners, as we Americans call them, all three of those know what they want to build, more of their own types of ships, and they really don't give a damn about the rest of the Navy. So within this lack of strategy, you have a lack of what kind of ships we want and how many and what we want to do with them.
And it's worth pointing out, to provide a little context to this, that it's currently, 2013. Get in the Wayback Machine and go back 30 years and start saying what the world of 2013 is like in 1982. What are the chances you won't be institutionalized and put in a mental home?
Very small. No, it's predicting the future is difficult. Some people would say impossible. But by the same token, there are trends. For example, we have not had an amphibious assault across the beach since 1950 at Incheon. Yet, the Marine Corps is again trying to develop an amphibious tractor or a fighting vehicle. And the major one they had, after 10 years of development and a few billion dollars, was canceled last year. The Marine Corps is trying to develop another across-the-beach assault vehicle. It's ridiculous. It's been 63 years since we've gone across a beach. That's why God invented helicopters, the V-22 V-STOL aircraft, to carry troops over the beach, not onto the beach.
And what landing craft we have are able to be very agile under a variety of conditions, such as the LCAC and the ever-popular LCU, which still has utility
The LCU, which is a boat, the LCAC, which is an air cushion vehicle, these are not assault vehicles. They don't carry troops in for combat. They carry the tanks, the backup equipment, the bulldozers, the other things. They are not used to land troops on the beach, and yet the Marines, as I say, are again looking at different types of vehicles that can go from an amphibious ship 25 miles offshore, and all of the studies say they have to remain at least 25 miles offshore because of the threat from shore-based missiles.
And it's worth pointing out to our listeners that the reason we're talking about the Marine Corps is there is the U.S. Navy, but within the Department of the Navy, there is also the U.S. Marine Corps, and they are sister services in this case.
And 30-some of the Navy's 280-some ships, 30-some of them are amphibious ships designed to carry Marines and their equipment and helicopters.
Now, you were talking a little bit about LCS. What, in theory, makes these ships attractive to the U.S. Navy in the context of moving the fleet into the mid-21st century?
A lot of people in and out of the Navy don't feel they move the Navy anywhere. But these were ships designed by Vern Clark when he was Chief of Naval Operations a decade ago. And Vern envisioned a 3,000-ton ship that would have space for modules, for containers, if you will. And the thought was that this ship goes out, it has a hangar, a helicopter deck, a hangar for manned helicopters and unmanned helicopters. And when she goes to sea, you put these modules or containers on, which have within them combat capabilities, such as anti-surface, weapons to fire at small surface craft attacking your ships, anti-submarine systems, and mine countermeasures or minesweeping systems. Unfortunately, the first three or four LCSs are in commission. They've all had major mechanical difficulties, which is strange because they're relatively simple designs, coupled with not one of the three basic modules or container sets is ready for production. We can't get them right. This is after more than a decade of developing them. And yet we've done anti-surface, mine countermeasures, and anti-submarine operations for close to 100 years.
Let's move on.
LCS, in my opinion, John, is just has failed on several levels. It's failed on the ship size. The ship construction and design itself. It's failed on the thought of having very small crews, 30, 40 people. We're now increasing the crews because we realize to operate and fight a ship of that size, you need more people, and none of the containerized modules are ready for service.
Not a happy situation in that program. And, of course, the Navy would like to build 55 of those, of course.
52 is the current program.
Okay, 52.
It changed in the last couple months or so.
Okay. Hopefully, moving on to happier waters, let's talk a little bit about amphibious shipping. How are we doing in that arena now, these days? I mean,
well,
what about the ships we're building now, the America-class amphibious large amphibious assault ships and the LPD-17 landing dock ships?
Well, the smaller dock landing ships, the San Antonio or LPD-17 class, LPD-17 cost twice as much as was scheduled and took twice as long to build, and in my opinion was a total disaster and never should have been accepted by the Navy. As I say, she took twice as long to build. When she was delivered, she was not ready for service for another couple of years. When she finally got underway, made a deployment to the Middle East, she had oil problems, oil line problems, and had to be laid up in the shipyard there, and crews flown out from the U.S. to repair her. Ship was a disaster. After several years, they finally got the problem straightened out, and additional ships are being built. We should build more of them because, in my opinion, we need more than approximately 30 amphibious ships. I think the last couple of wars we've had, Afghanistan and Iraq being the most recent, have taught us that putting troops on the ground just causes us lots of casualties. It costs us lots of money. We have to build airfields to support them. We have to bring security people in, and on and on and on. Officer clubs, fuel depots, mess halls, barracks. Keep all those things and all those people aboard ship and fly them in for raids, such as when we got Osama bin Laden and other people. When we went into Afghanistan, what was it, John, 2001?
Yep,
where we flew them off the Kitty Hawk.
Yep.
When we went in off the Kitty Hawk, what year was that?
2001.
2001, we flew several hundred special forces from an aircraft carrier, which was 600 miles away in the Indian Ocean. We flew them into Afghanistan. We should have left them there for a week or two to kill all the Taliban they could find, destroy the facilities, and then get them out. But instead, we Americans love to put infrastructure into places so we can affect the future of the countries. And in Afghanistan and Iraq, both, it was a bloody disaster.
We're fine warriors.
I just
we're
think
lousy
we need,
occupiers.
Well, since World War II, certainly, I think we need more amphibious ships. We need them for special forces as well as Marines, and put them in forward areas, rotate the troops, rotate the ships as necessary. But when there's a crisis ranging from having to evacuate an embassy to killing some bad guys, fly them in by helicopter, by the Osprey, the V-22 V-STOL aircraft, fly them in off of these amphibious ships, kill them, and then come back. Don't build an infrastructure. But in answer to your original question, the LPD-17 San Antonio class, we've solved most of the problems. I think we should just keep building them until we have about 20 of them. And the same with the LHA-LHDs, which are the big, they look like aircraft carriers, and they're as big as World War II carriers, but they cost about a fifth or a quarter as much as an aircraft carrier today. And I just think we should keep building those at one every year or two.
Which takes us to one of your favorite classes of ships, for which you have written pretty much the definitive guide to them, aircraft carriers. What is the current state of the American aircraft carrier fleet and the new model, the USS Ford, that we're constructing?
Well, two issues. One, we have 10 large aircraft carriers, all nuclear-powered, all about 100,000 tons, all can carry about 65, 70 airplanes. Takes about 3,500 people to run one of these ships, men and women, and then you put another 1,500, so you're up to close to 5,000 with the air wing. We have 10 of these ships. One of them is in a two-year nuclear refueling process right now. I think we should keep those 10 as long as they can serve. We are building a new class. The Ford is well under construction. Named for a great naval hero of World War II, Gerald Ford, who was later president. And, of course, I'm being facetious. But Gerald Ford will cost about $15, $16, $17 billion. And I think
that's with
after
a B.
The first, with a B.
With a
as
B.
As I just had a car.
And lots of commas.
Lots of commas and zeros. But I think after we build the Ford, we should stop building them for a decade, build more of the one-third the size LHAs, LHDs, because we now have a fighter being developed, the F-35C, B, the F-35B, that can operate from those smaller ships. That's the Joint Strike Fighter, the Marine Corps version. I think we should build more of those ships and just stop big carrier construction for a decade for a number of reasons. The big carriers have less capability than they did 20, 30 years ago. They're costing unbelievable amount of money, tie up a lot of people. tie up a lot of people and just are not the way to go in this day and age.
Moving on to submarines. What's our submarine force looking like these days?
Well, we're building almost 2 attack torpedo attack subs, nuclear powered, per year. And there's no problem with that. The big problem is a new ballistic missile sub, strategic submarine, to replace the 14 Ohio class submarines we have. That program is also a mess. It's a mess because trying to cut the cost from $5 or $6 billion, again with a B, per submarine, which is just unconscionable, we are cutting out non-acoustic stealth features. We're saying, hey, we'll make it quiet, and that's good enough. Well, it's not, because the sub's going to be commissioned. They're going to be commissioned in the 2020s, and they're going to be around for 40 years. And there are already non-acoustic detection methods that I feel will make them exceedingly vulnerable during their lifetime. And what you don't want to the strategic system is vulnerability. I think that whole program has to be rethought.
Okay. And finally, general purpose escorts, or what we like to call destroyers. Where is the destroyer program these days, and what are we going to be doing in the next 10 to 15 years with it?
Well, we have 80-some destroyers and cruisers, basically the same type of ship. Very good with the Aegis anti-air missile system, anti-submarine systems. We lack an effective surface-to-surface weapon now. The Harpoon is more than 40 years old, which is our basic surface-to-surface missile. It's more than 40 years old, and although it's been upgraded, we need a new surface-to-surface missile. 80-some destroyers is enough. I would keep building 2 or 3 per year so we can keep up that number. But what's needed is a frigate, a smaller ship, the littoral combat ship, which some people thought would become the modern frigate, has been a failure, in my opinion. As I said earlier, a failure in many ways, John. And I think it's time to reintroduce the frigate in the fleet. We have 19 now, and they're being decommissioned during the next few years.
These are the Oliver Hazard Perry class guided missile frigates that were, if you will, part of the low mix.
No, they're not guided missile frigates because we took the missile system off a decade ago.
But these were the ships that provided the general purpose low end part of the mix back during the Cold War. And to our listeners, we have just lost Mr. Pulmar. We will try and get him back. Continuing what he was saying, though, the current state of the destroyer force is that we have been building the same basic destroyer, the Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, now since the 1980s. And let's get Mr. Pulmar on to talk a little bit more about that. Hang on. And Norman, are you back with us?
Yes. Can you repeat the question, though?
Okay. I was just leading, hopefully, towards a question when I was praying you would come back on. We've been building the same basic destroyer now since the 1980s. These are the Arleigh Burke-class destroyers. Now, you know, we've been building them since the 80s. What is next after the Burkes, or is it Burkes forever?
Right now, it's Burkes forever. The Burke is a good ship, and I don't see, because of the fiscal situation this country's in and the other problems that, in my opinion, the Navy is facing, the littoral combat ship, the big aircraft carrier, not enough amphibious ships, etc., I would just keep building Burke-class ships, improving them. It'll cost, but still improve them. Especially with a new surface-to-surface missile. But beyond that, at this stage, the only change I would make in surface warships is to definitely, in the next year or two, initiate a new frigate program. Ships of about 4,000 tons, 5,000 tons max, capable of handling helicopters, capable of 29, 30-knot speeds. And indeed, you could take the Oliver Hazard Perry class, which dates to the early 1970s, and there are several proposed to upgrade those, and that might be an affordable way to do it.
In other words, take essential parts like the engineering plant, the basic layout, and smooth off the hull, put a new deck house on it, and produce something little more akin.
You can easily lengthen. I've spoken to naval architects about this. You can easily lengthen the ship 20 feet, which would give you room to put more surface-to-surface missiles on it. You can look at what the Australians have done of putting surface-to-air missiles on top of the ship, that is, into the ship, beyond its Mark 13 launcher, which can launch both surface-to-air missiles and the Harpoon anti-ship missile. So there's flexibility in the design, but fine, come up with a new one quickly. But I think we must, in the next couple of years, initiate a class of frigate-type ships for the U.S. Navy. Right now, we have Aegis destroyers. These are 9,000-ton ships, which cost $2 billion, chasing 36-foot skiffs, pirate skiffs off the coast of Ethiopia and such, in the Gulf of Aden, and it's just wrong. Those are ideal jobs for frigates, blockade, monitoring areas, because most of the world's threats to our navies are very low.
Let's move on and talk a little about aircraft programs. How's the Navy doing? And we're going to split this because I know there's now two separate tracks here. First is manned aircraft programs. What is the current state of manned aircraft programs within the U.S. Navy, and what's the news in that arena?
Not very much. The F-35, the Joint Strike Fighter, the Navy plans to procure in two variants, the F-35C, which is a carrier-based version, that is, it'll have tailhook capable of catapult launches, and the F-35B, and the B variant is primarily for the U.S. Marine Corps, although the British and several other countries are plan to buy it. But the V version is a VSTOL, vertical short takeoff and landing. And that is a type of aircraft that can operate, and it's a high-performance semi-stealth aircraft that can operate from these 40,000-ton LHA-LHD amphibious ships. And indeed, during a couple of times during Gulf aerial wars, we unloaded the helicopters and put 24 Harriers, which are the current VSTOL fighter aircraft on board, turning them to miniature aircraft carriers, or as the British like to call them, Harrier carriers.
And that worked out well, correct?
It worked out very well, with no significant problems. For the same token... Oh, go ahead.
And again, no land-based footprint whatsoever in that particular case.
Right. As far as other aircraft, cargo aircraft, reconnaissance, those were doing okay. I'm disappointed in the P-8, which is a new maritime patrol aircraft, which replaces or will replace the P-3 Orion. In my opinion, it has, being a pure jet, it has some limitations. Its loiter time is less. It'll fly at higher altitudes, and hence when it comes down to do what they call rigging, looking at surface ships, it's going to burn a lot of fuel. It does not have a magnetic anomaly detector, which is very useful, especially in shallow areas, shallow water areas, for detecting, for pinpointing the location of submarines, which you've detected by other sensors. So I'm disappointed at the P-8. I'm disappointed we're only planning to buy 100, whereas we've procured several hundred P-3 Orions over the years. We have a couple of hundred of them flying right now.
Let's move over to a somewhat happier topic, at least this week, and that is the unmanned side. After decades of allowing other services to play in the unmanned arena, the last couple of years have seen just an absolute explosion of unmanned aerial systems being adopted, tested, evaluated by the Navy for use aboard ships
and
other places.
John, I'm sorry, I have to take very strong issue with you. Navy launched in-combat unmanned attack aircraft during the Korean War. We took F-6F fighters, loaded them with bombs, launched them off of aircraft carriers, and flew them into cave openings where we knew the North Koreans were stockpiling weapons. In addition, in the 1960s, the Navy procured, I think the number was 723 unmanned helicopters called DASH, drone anti-submarine helicopter, and we deployed them aboard 100 and some destroyers. They weren't very successful, but the Navy's always been a leader in unmanned aircraft. In the early 1980s, under John Lehman, the Israeli Scout or Mistaf UAVs were procured for the U.S. Navy under the name of Pioneer, and those flew until a few years ago by the Navy, Marine Corps, and the Army. So the Navy has always been in the forefront, John, of unmanned aircraft, including, some that we still can't talk about.
Well, having been suitably corrected on my history gaffe there,
I still love you, John.
And you got to admit, they've had a hell of a couple of years here bringing new systems into operational use, into testing, and, of course, last week doing something that was just amazing. Last week,
they took a very large unmanned aircraft, which still has an experimental number, the X-47, and they flew it on. They launched it from an aircraft carrier, from the steam catapults. No big deal. I mean, it's an aircraft. You hook it up to the catapult, you rev it up, and the steam catapult just shoots it off. By the same token, they made what are called touch-and-go landings, and this is the aircraft unmanned, the X-47, came in for a landing, touched down on the deck, but then the remote controls pilot accelerated it, and it took off again. It did not stop on the carrier. That, to me, was very impressive and demonstrates that at some stage in the next few years, we'll probably start procuring a weaponized and sensorized, if you will, version of the X-47 and start putting it aboard some carriers. How well it will fit in with manned aircraft, that's highly questionable still. But the Navy's making great progress there, but the Navy's always led in unmanned aircraft.
I think one of the things that impresses me most about the 47 program, as well as several of the other unmanned systems programs being run by NAVAIR, is the very methodical and old-school way that they are doing envelope expansion, conservatively moving from point to point in the test programs. This is very old-school and what you expect of a really great Navy. And I have to say, as gloomy as some of the things that you've talked about are, that is what's going on down at NAVAIR and the Unmanned Systems Directorate. Someone down there is obviously doing a very good job right now.
Well, NAVAIR, the Naval Air Systems Command, in my opinion, does an excellent job of developing, testing, and integrating aircraft into the fleet. Unfortunately, as we've just discussed, things like the LPD-17, the San Antonio amphibious ships, littoral combat ships, these demonstrate that the Naval Sea Systems Command, which is in charge, NAVSEA, which is in charge of the ships, does not do as good or methodical a job. Now, the problem is we are on a very conservative course in aircraft. And even with the Joint Strike Fighter, this VSTOL semi-stealth aircraft, we are doing it very methodically. Sometimes, in order to keep ahead of the opposition, and you have to define the opposition, I realize, you have to take some chances. You have to have a more advanced, almost exciting track also to follow. But as you say, NAVAIR is doing an excellent job of how it's developing these aircraft. Unfortunately, the Joint Strike Fighter has had many, many bumps in the road and is behind schedule, over cost. Part of it is it's developing one airframe for three different missions, Air Force, Navy, and Marine. And there I have problems with that approach to things. We tried it during the McNamara era in the 1960s for a single aircraft called the TFX, which became, in Air Force parlance, the F-111. and after many years, one of several versions proved successful. But joint aircraft projects like this of multi-service, multi-mission are rarely successful. A better way to do it is let one service develop the aircraft and then see if it works for others, and that certainly made the Phantom, the Navy's F-4, McDonnell Douglas Phantom, the most popular Western fighter of several decades back in the 60s and 70s.
Arguably perhaps the greatest warplane of all time, given the context.
Oh, very arguably. I would argue that on several levels, John, over lunch next time we get together.
Oh, yes. Well, let us face it, Norman, we have both had enough birthdays to know that the old engineering adage that a camel is a thoroughbred horse designed by a committee applies here.
Very good.
Well, people are probably wondering, you know, you and I have just covered a vast array of topics and, you know, gotten down to some fairly granular detail out of our heads, and that's fine for you and I, but what happens to the interested observer, perhaps a young man or woman who's interested in the Navy and wants to know more about it? Where might they go to learn more about their Navy and their sea services? And this is a shameless hint and plug.
Just go online to www.navy.mil. And if nothing else, look up under press at the images, the photography and the film of the U.S. Navy. And from a public relations viewpoint, the Navy does great in lots of great photography and lots of great film. So the first place to go is online, www.navy.mil. Second place to go is a book, you may have heard of this, John, called Ships and Aircraft of the U.S. Fleet, published by the Naval Institute. You can get it on Amazon at a good discount. The book's a little pricey, but the book tells you more about the U.S. Navy than any other publication in existence.
And the author of that fine volume would be?
Some neat guy. But anyway, what else can I tell you?
For the record, that would be Norman Pulmar, our guest today, who has just brought out the 19th edition of this book.
My 9th and my last edition.
Talk a little about Ships and Aircraft and its history, because it has a history before you got it, and it has a history while you've been the caretaker of it.
Well, in about 1940, a New Yorker, I believe he was a fireman for most of his life, named Jim Fahey, brought out a little, this was 1939, brought out a little 48-page, I think it was, paperback pamphlet called Ships and Aircraft of the U.S. Fleet. And he privately printed it, sold it himself. It did exceedingly well, and over the next decade, he brought out eight more editions. I'm sorry, seven more, a total of eight small paperbacks. As Jim was getting old, and I had the privilege of knowing him, he was quite a cantankerous but an interesting guy. Jim, as I said, did eight small paperback editions. As he was aging, he sold it to the Naval Institute, which published two more paperback editions, but they were not very well received. They had a lot of problems with organization, structure, and just a lot of problems. So the Naval Institute asked me if I would take over the project. Well, at the time, I was editor of the United States sections. That's the United States, Taiwan, South Korea, South Vietnam, Philippines, and some other navies of Jane's Fighting Ships, the British published annual of all the world's navies, which is now primarily sold as an electronic book. But they had asked me earlier if I would do a book for them for the Naval Institute called Guide to the Soviet Navy, which I was doing. And they asked me if I'd do Ships and Aircraft. Well, there was a new editor of Jane's, John Moore, and I just decided that it was time for me to move on. So I took over Ships and Aircraft with the proviso that it would be done exactly the way Guide to the Soviet Navy was being done as far as layout, format, page size, ship descriptions, etc., since I designed that myself. Well, they let
you
me do it.
You designed that format because I remember what a handy size and what a pleasant, you know, reading experience that those books were back in the day.
Well, thank you. So I did. It became a hardback, whereas Fahey and the two issues Enable Institute had done before, two editions before I got there, were paperback. It became a hardback, and it has sold exceedingly well. As a matter of fact, every midshipman coming into the Naval Academy is issued one of them, and it's also widely used by NROTC, Naval Reserve Officer Training Corps, and of course, almost every foreign navy buys a pile of them for their intelligence services. It's been exceedingly successful, but I've done 9 hardback editions, plus I think it was 5 hardback editions of Guide to the Soviet Navy, and I just want to move on to some other book projects.
You talked about developing the format, the layout, if you will, the user interface, as we would describe it in computer terms, for the reader to the book. And the ships and aircraft and other things that you describe in it. Talk about what a reader of this 19th edition is going to see when they open it up. And let's start by saying, this is a heavy book. It has some heft to it. This is something you're proud to put on your bookshelf. Correct?
Or hit somebody over the head with.
Yes, it can be used as a deadly weapon.
I start off with a chapter called State of the Fleet, which is my view, and we've gone over a lot of that today, John, my view of where the U.S. Navy is today and where it's probably headed. Then I talk about personnel. I talk about the different designations the Navy uses for ships. And today we've thrown out LHA, LHD, LCS, and there are a couple of hundred of those. But then I talk about the Marine Corps. The book also discusses the Coast Guard, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which operates a large fleet of ships and aircraft. And those, of course, in wartime would become part of the Navy, both the Coast Guard and NOAA. But then I go into each type of ship, aircraft carriers, submarines, submersibles, all the small stuff that goes underwater that the Navy operates. Then I go into, I still have 2 pages on the Iowa-class battleships, though they are no longer in service and can never be returned to service. They've been turned into museums, but battleships still a lot of interest. Then cruisers and destroyers, which I lump together since they're basically the same today. Then littoral combat ships, frigates, amphibious ships, auxiliary ships, floating dry docks. If the Navy owns it, it floats, you're going to find it. Then there are several
garbage
chapters.
Cows.
No. Well, yeah, I mentioned those. I just mentioned those.
Yes, you do. I've already seen it. You do.
And probably a photo or two. The book, by the way, has a couple of thousand photos, I think. I've never counted them. On top of that, of course, there's a chapter on naval aviation, which lists every aviation squadron in the Navy, the wings, the groups, how they're organized. Then a chapter on the aircraft themselves. Each aircraft's described, its technical description, its specifications, how many we bought, when it became operational, first flights, things like that. And then there's a chapter on unmanned aircraft, because there are so many being used by the Navy and Marine Corps.
Now, you don't really start a new edition. You continue from the past edition and just kind of update it as individual bits and pieces of data come to you, correct?
Well, I do both. I start, for instance, State of the Fleet, a blank sheet of paper. This year with the littoral combat ship, that chapter started with a blank sheet of paper. But cruisers, destroyers, since most of the ones that are of the 84 that are in commission today, about 60 of them were in commission 5 years ago, when the previous edition of Ships and Aircraft came out. So some of it's updated, some of it's brand new.
And this is part of the reason you're moving on, is that you've done this now through 9 editions. How many years is that out of your life that this book has been part of your work?
Well, except I've done a lot of other things, including work, helped raise a family with children, and now four grandchildren. And I've written the average of a published book a year. I've written a couple of other books that were not published. No one was interested in Sexual Mores of Fairfax County, Virginia, 1820 to 1829. I could never sell that manuscript.
Darn that.
But,
well, you never know. But, it could come on as we move into the 21st. But
about 1977, as I recall, is when the Naval Institute asked me to do ships and aircraft. So that's 35 years, 9 editions in 36 years.
I know that in that time, the book, you've had something of a love-hate relationship with the book, because it's obviously very difficult to produce, maintain, and you probably put more into it than you've ever been paid. But at the same time, it is very much a signature, you know, book in your, you know, professional resume. Looking back on it, what do you remember best about the book? At its best, what was the book like producing?
Wow, meeting interesting people. Unquestionably meeting interesting people. Program managers, people aboard ships I've visited. In my career, I've been very fortunate. I've been aboard every type of ship in the U.S. Navy, from nuclear and diesel subs to a month at sea in the carrier Forrestal in the Mediterranean. I've been aboard minesweepers at sea, PT boats at sea. I've gone into Libya with an EOD team. I've been on landing ships, command ships. I've been on sea in Israeli ships, British ships. I've been aboard Russian, several Soviet ships, cruisers and destroyers, submarines. I would say the highlight has been, one, the people I've met, and two, the ships I've been able to get aboard. I spent a week at sea in a battleship. Been on all four Iowas, three of them tied up, and as I say, when the New Jersey was at sea, I spent a week in her. In 1982, an interesting year, I was aboard HMS Hermes, the British aircraft carrier that was in the Falklands. I've been in British submarines, been aboard Chinese destroyers, Israeli missile boats, Israeli submarines. So I'd say the highlights have been, one, the people I've met related to my research for ships and aircraft and related naval books, and second is being on the ships themselves.
You know, in a way, ships and aircraft has been a magnet that has drawn a lot of people to you. I know myself, it was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about when we first met back in Monterey in the 1980s.
That's true. I get a lot of fan letters, a lot of critical letters, not a lot, occasionally a critical letter, but I do get fan letters, and several people I've built up relationships with who have helped me on the book over the years, both, I want to say, grown-ups and kids, of whom most of them are now grown up.
Yeah, it's taken on a certain life of its own. Does the Naval Institute plan on continuing the book? Are they going to find someone else to take over the editorship?
That's a good question. Since it's about 4 years between editions, they've got a couple of years to think about that. We've had a couple of meetings about the type of person they need to produce the book. But beyond that, they certainly have made no, to the best of my knowledge, have made no decisions. As I say, I've been chatting with them about this, about what qualities they need in the person who's going to do it should they continue. I have a feeling something will be continued which may even have the same name. Whether or not they can produce a 640 or whatever number of pages this edition is, a book every 4 years as comprehensive as this, I just don't know if it can really realistically be done. It should be easier because of the Internet. But let me say, there is so much bum dope on the Internet these days, just bad data, even about ships. But it's a labor-intensive project.
In many real ways, you almost have to. You have almost been an intelligence analyst and filer.
I cannot discuss that with you over an open line.
Of course not. Well, Norman, I want to thank you for coming on and giving us a good look at the state of the U.S. Navy, as well as talking a little bit about your book. Let's ask one final question. What are you working on now? What's the next few things you have on your plate right now?
Are you sitting down, John?
Yes, I'm. As a matter of fact, I am. Rather comfortable chair.
Good. I'm under contract for 3 books right now. An update of a book I did in 1991, which got me involved with the Soviet, then Russian, submarine community, and that is a book I did in 1991 with a Dutch intelligence officer, Jurien Noot, entitled Submarines of the Russian and Soviet Navies. We're revising that, which is quite a job.
Oh, really? Excellent.
Second book I'm under contract for is with Ed Whitman, former chief scientist of 6th Fleet and the Officer Chief of Naval Operations. Ed and I are doing the first true, definitive, semi-technical history of anti-submarine warfare. And the third book with Tom Wildenberg, with whom I did a book on the history of the torpedo a couple of years ago, which has done very well. Tom and I are doing a history of anti-air warfare in the U.S. Navy. How do you defend ships, starting with the Billy Mitchell era, with machine guns and then real guns and then better guns and then missiles? So those are my 3 current book projects. Plus, I write columns, as you know, for both the Naval Institute Proceedings and for the Naval Institute's magazine, Naval History. So those, grandchildren, and some other writing, not to mention consulting, keep me kind of busy.
Well, gee, it's nice to know that you're still active.
Thanks.
One of these days, you're going to have to explore the concept of slowing down, sir.
Right. I want you to keep believing that, John.
No, I don't believe it for you or for me. Anyway, Norman, thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I hope we'll have you on again sometime soon.
John, I always enjoy being with you, even if it's over a telephone line.
Okay.
Take care, my friend.
You too.
Bye-bye.
And with that, we're going to close out this week's edition of Military Monday. Be back next Monday when we'll be talking to David Isby about his thoughts on the future of worldwide special operations forces. We're coming to the end of the long wars of the first decade of the 21st century. What will special operations look like as we move into 2020? Be with us then at 1 p.m. for Military Monday.